Okay. So, having that logistics out of the way, let us talk about power. Power will be our topic for the day primarily. I do want you to sort of make sure we have all the pieces of the things we've talked about so far with our processors handled. Okay, so we started by talking about how processors did more than just a simple one cycle per instruction. They actually did something called a pipeline. And then we showed that, ooh, they don't really even do a pipeline. They have these functional units and reorder buffers and renaming. And I'm not sure that I clearly conveyed how those things work together. So we had talked about the idea that we could sort of think of a single instruction running down a pipeline, and we showed a five-stage pipeline as we were dealing with in class. We showed a fetch, decode, execute, memory, write back. Okay, and then we commented that real processors will actually often have a 10 to 12 stage pipeline. But then after saying that, we then started saying, oh, but real processors use this out of order execution instead. How do these two things work together? And while I do think I alluded to this in last lecture, I'm not sure I alluded to it very clearly. So I wanted to come back to this idea of we may have this longer pipeline where somewhere in the middle we have out of order. Okay, so we may have some process of fetching and understanding and renaming and issuing. Maybe we take a few cycles to issue to make sure it gets to the functional units and gets to the reorder buffer. Okay, and then they may go off to different task queues for our different functional units, as we discussed, and end up coming back into our reorder buffer. And then it is possible that the steps needed to complete them may also take multiple cycles. So there may be a process of updating the register files and updating the flags and making sure memory has been written and so forth. So in general, we can have a pipeline and an out of order part in the middle. And those out of order parts, right? If I think, for example, about my multiplier, we might make a four-stage deep pipeline for our multiplier as well. So it may have its own issue queue and send things out to the reorder buffer when it's done, but it may also be executing an instruction for multiple cycles in a pipeline system. So we tend to have both of these things going on in modern high-performance processors today. That's just clarifying something I don't know if I explained particularly well. Also, a diagram that I usually have presented and just somehow never really fit. Well, actually, I may come back and talk about that Monday in context of the next assignment. So I'll hold off on that till I can pull up the website and do some pictures. All right, so this is some core context of where we went. And one of the assumptions we made of all of this was that we were trying to maximize throughput. In particular, when we're discussing throughput, we mean the total instructions we manage to run. So the total instructions divided by the total time. We want this to be as big as possible. What we're really saying is we make the total time small, but that of course depends on the number of instructions. And so we target some large, we want this to be a large number. We're able to do many instructions per unit time. This is not the same thing as talking about our clock speed. Our clock speed is how long it takes to go from stage to stage. And so while we generally report our clock speed, we might say, for example, maybe we have a 2.4 gigahertz processor. That means clock speed, the fastest the clock can tick. We'll talk about why we'll make it slower today. We might also want to talk about some other unit for dealing with how things work. And the most common of these is flops. FLOPS being a, not really an acronym, but a short version of floating point operations per second. Okay, so I guess if you take FL from floating point, this works. But FLOPS are one effort at trying to measure this. Floating point, why do we pick floating point instead of integer? Like it's something somebody did fairly early on. And a lot of floating point operations, multiplying in particular, take enough work that you can often get close to what your processor can do independent of dependencies. So this isn't necessarily the most useful measure for common applications, but it's a measure that matters for certain kinds of scientific and simulation kind of things. And so you can sometimes find the gigaflops of your processor described. And that's an estimate. The clock hertz is something we can physically define for our chip. We can change the speed of the clock. We can get that exactly right. Our flops is for a given set of instructions when we ran them this time, given our speculations and so forth. So that's a little bit fuzzier. But what we really want to know is how long will my code take to run? And none of these really tell us that. So that's just something to know. But we're trying to maximize, all of these things are based on maximizing throughput, getting tasks done in less overall wall clock time. That, however, is not the only thing we want to deal with. We want to minimize power. Okay? For various reasons, whether you believe it's in, whether you're sort of motivated by the ecological version or because you want your cell phone to run for a long time or whatever the reason is, we very often want to make sure that our processors consume less power. Let's consider slash remind ourselves of several things. Power is the result of current times voltage. Okay, so I in this means current. And that is how many electrons are traveling across the wire per second approximately. It's the flow of electricity. V stands for voltage, and this is the pressure of the electrons, how much force is being applied on each electron to try to cause it to keep moving. And if we think about this being power, let's just try to compare it to other sorts of things. We know from Newton's laws that something moving quickly but with no resistance has no voltage, there's no pressure on it, it just drifts along, and it requires no power to drift along. Also, if I press really hard on something but it doesn't move, like for example, gravity is doing on me against the floor right now, that's not creating any power either. So if there's no current or no power, no motion or no pressure, there is no power. But if I am moving and have pressure causing me to move, then I am accelerating and that requires power. So our power is a result of both movement and pressure in an electrical sense for computers. Another thing to understand about this is that voltage is current times resistance. Okay, or a parallel notion that force is the speed times the opposite force. This is sort of the electrical version of every action has an equal and opposite reaction. If I am moving and something is pressing against me, then I have to be pressing against that thing that's pressing against me. There is this sort of reciprocal relationship. And so we can see here that having more current is going to cause me more power. If I keep the voltage constant, that's a linear increase. If I keep the resistance constant, that's a quadratic increase. But one way or other, having current is a problem. And if I could make the voltage lower, I could get the power down as well. So let's think about where we get voltage and current. How do these things appear in processors? How could we design a low power processor? And we actually do design low power processors. We have the two main sort of consumer processor designs today. x86 uses a lot of power and is very efficient. ARM uses a lot less power and is less efficient. And we tend to use one in mobile devices running off of batteries, the other one in devices that get plugged in, or laptops have great big beefy batteries. So we have this trade-off. We design processors to have different results here. How do we go about doing that? let's consider an AND gate. And there's multiple ways we could design an AND gate. We're going to start with an older design that is not used anymore very much and talk about why it isn't used very much anymore. Okay. And since we certainly haven't done very many circuits, let me just remind you of what these things mean slash teach you if you didn't already know. So this will be A and B over here. We commonly write the source of power as just a line. And it's almost always at the top of the picture, right? So we have power, some sort of source of voltage coming in here. And generally we assume it has sort of an unlimited amount of electrons it could provide for us. We draw here, this is a sink or ground. If we had a connection between power and ground, we would have huge current because power has a lot of voltage. The ground wants to consume all the electricity it can. Power wants to run from sink to ground. This here is a resistor. It slows down the flow of power. And these are transistors, enabled if voltage comes along here. And so the idea of this particular circuit is if you put voltage on A and B, it's going to open up both of these gates, and the power is going to flow down. It wants to get to the ground, but it's being slowed down here, and so it diverts to that wire there. So this design of a gate can work. And you can build these in some large systems before we had integrated circuits and even some early integrated circuits in some cases would use some design like this, but it has a problem, okay? Let's think about what happens here. How strong should my resistor be? If I have a very, so let's just consider a strong, a high resistance resistor and a weak, a low resistance resistor. If I have a very strong resistor, once I close these gates, it's going to take some time for the pressure on A and B to drain through the resistor and down to the ground. And so that means I'm going to have a slower system. It's going to take a while for a change in A and B to result in a change in the output. If I have a weak resistor, then when the gates are open, I'm going to be consuming a lot of power. Power is going to be running through this system. The resistor is not going to slow it down very much. I'm going to have pretty strong power from source to ground. Okay? And so with this design, my trade-offs are not great. I can make a slower processor or a more power-consuming processor, and that's the trade-off I can make. Some level of this will remain true in more complicated processors. But one of the things we can try to do to simplify and reduce the power usage of a processor is use a different design for our transistors and our gates. So we're going to talk about MOSFET and CMOS, which are actually going to go together. MOSFET is short for the metal oxide semiconductor. That's the MOS in both of these. Metal oxide semiconductor means is MOS. And so there are different ways of making the semiconductors we make things out of. Metal oxide is what this one is referred to. And then we have FET, standing for the field effect transistor. This is not an electrical engineering class. I am not going to go into detail about what a field effect transistor is, but it's one of several ways of making a transistor. Here, the C stands for complementary metal oxide semiconductors. And we will typically use these together in modern integrated circuits, modern printed circuits on silicon. Let's sort of explore a particular gate here. Actually, let me just mention a few things. So when we say complementary, we have two kinds of transistors in MOSFET. We have one kind of transistor called I believe this is a P-type transistor. The P-type transistor is turned off by the existence of power and on when we remove it, or the existence of voltage, which is why we draw it with a little circle. Okay, so this is a P-type. P-type transistors are somewhat limited. They're good at allowing voltage into a system, but bad at draining it out. So we'll typically put them attached to power, but we won't put them in other places. We also have the N-type transistor. Okay, the N-type transistor works in both cases. It can both draw power in and take power out. But it is turned on by the existence of voltage instead of being turned off. We designed these two things with our MOSFETs, okay? And then when we call it complementary when we lay them out in a particular way. Let's take a classic CMOS gate. So I'm going to draw the gate here first. It's going to be more complicated than one we just drew, although it's not going to have a resistor, as we're going to see. So let's call that A and that B, and this is going to be our output C. And then down here, we are going to do this. And we're going to put another copy of A and another copy of B down there. All right, let's think a little bit about this transistor. I have source coming in, and it will run unless I turn off A and B. So unless A and B are turned off, power will be entering the system from either A or B. And since these wires are all connected, it doesn't matter which of A or B is turned on, or unless they're both turned on, I've got this flow of electricity. So if either of them is off, I've got electricity flowing into the system. The electricity, however, can only flow down to ground if both A and B are true, right? These default to being off, okay? And so if we consider our sort of truth table of how this works, all of the possible combinations, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, okay? If there's no voltage on A and no voltage on B, then there's no connection to ground. There is a connection to both sources. And so I'm going to see C is being turned on. If there's no connection to A, but there is to B, then I've still got power coming in via A, but it can't make it past this A gate. Sorry, and I can make it past this A gate because that one isn't, sorry, can't make it past that one. That one's closed because A is off. And so I have power coming in here, can't make it out there, going over here. It's coming in here, it can't make it. So I have power coming in here, can't go down, can't go back up, and so it comes out the side. So I've got pressure on C. Everything I just said about A also works with B. If I have power coming in B, it wants to get to ground. It can make it past A, but it can't make it past B. And so its only output is to go to C. And if they are both turned on, I have no power entering the system and I am connected to ground. And so I'm going to pull C to being nothing. This is a NAND gate. Okay. One of the really nice things about this gate is that I don't ever have a there's a bit of resistance, but we're still connecting power to ground, like I did in this simpler model. I don't have leakage beyond assuming my transistors work as they're designed, as we hope they would work. And I have this sort of synchronous characteristic. I have this complementary behavior. For every one of my inputs, it's either letting something in or letting it out in this complementary one or the other kind of way, which is why we call it CMOS. And so this can get me so that I'm always connected to either power or ground. So I don't have to worry about the slow drain through a resistor. So I don't have the slowness. And I never connect source to ground directly. So I don't have to worry about the loss of power. So this design allows me to save a lot of power and without a significant loss in efficiency. It's not the only kind of innovation we can make in the design of our systems. It means we're going to have to rethink a little bit the basic gates. NAND gates are easy to do this way, but AND gates aren't. And so we're actually going to implement an AND with a NAND and a NOT. And there's going to be some other extra things. And if you were in some electrical engineering, computer engineering classes, we'll talk about some of these designs. But switching our technology can save us power. Similarly, if we could come up with slightly different materials that could transition at a lower voltage, then we could also save power and allow things to move along with less power. So this is one way we save power. We try to change the physical technology we are using. And this is ongoing research. We're always getting a little bit better. Rarely there are these big jumps where we figure out we've got these two different kinds of transistors. Much more commonly, we see small tweaks that make things run a little bit better in this space. So this is one kind of thing we can try to do to reduce power. Another thing we can try to do to reduce power is to look, so we have this power equals current times voltage equation. To reduce power, we have to reduce current, or we have to reduce voltage. Let's start with current. Okay, once we've switched to MOSFET, current happens during change. The more transistors change, the more wires change in our system, the more current we use. So when we come back to this model here, where we had dozens of register banks and lots of issues and wires all over the place and muxes everywhere, every single one of those gates and transistors changing in an instruction is going to consume some power. Having this deep pipeline and the out-of-order processors and the reorder buffer and all of those components, each one of those is going to draw a little power. And so one way we can do things is we can just simply, therefore we can make things simpler. Simpler is less power. We also talked last time about the idea that we have this whole micro-op system. We translate the instructions in your instruction code into different instructions. Well, that consumes power. So you have to analyze them, look them up, decide what to do. Every piece of work, conceptual information work, is also going to consume power. And so if I can break from backwards compatibility, if I can ignore all of those other instructions and make a new instruction set, there's just simple actions that I can do without a lot of extra work, then I can consume less power. It might not save me any time, because with things like out of order and micro ops and so on, I can get a really good throughput even with complicated instructions. But if I can make a simpler instruction set, then I can make less gates needed to do that, and I can consume less power along the way. And so this is part of the reason why we will see a new instruction set coming out when we want to make a lower power processor. By removing that backwards compatibility extra, we can move forward in making a simpler gate system that will make it. However, that also, almost inevitably, also means lower throughput. Because all of those fun things about pipelining and speculation and misprediction recovery and having a good predictor and out of order execution and reorder buffers, all of those things consume power and boost my throughput. Pardon me. So if we can sort of have this trade-off, a lower power machine will be slower because it can't use all of these extras. So one way we can try to find better underlying technology, lower power underlying technology. Second, we use a simpler ISA that does less work. We do less work, we consume less power. And that isn't restricted only to the processor. This also applies to our caching system. It applies to all of the components we've talked about. Anywhere there is work to do, if we can remove the work, we can save ourselves power. The other thing we can try to reduce is voltage. Reducing voltage has a variety of concerns. Let's just sort of consider overall, if I consider the state of a transistor, let's suppose I have 0 volts and 1 volt. Okay, let's suppose I have a transistor, it's sort of designed to have this 1 volt. And when this transistor transitions over time, we expect to see it do some sort of switching up from low to high, and then it's going to switch back when we have another situation. But there's going to be some time here, some transition time in which things are in a sort of undecided state. This transition is being driven by voltage. And so the more voltage we put in here, the faster that transition can happen. And so to some degree, we can reduce voltage depending on the constraints of our particular technology. Some degree of reducing voltage can just literally make the hardware move slower, but potentially still in the same way. Now we're going to have to design our systems for the new voltage. It's not just we can take an existing chip and crank down the voltage a little bit and expect to see a lower power, slower operation. We have to make sure all of the components are designed to work at our voltage. But we can pick a different voltage, a lower voltage, that will use less power and run less quickly, right? So lower power, that is to say lower voltage, equals slower here as well. So we can sacrifice a little speed to make things run a little slower. But there's not a huge amount we can do here. The nature of transistors is they have this sort of non-linear behavior, that there's a difference between them being open and closed. We want this binary behavior, because there's going to be a transition voltage at which that occurs, and so we can't get that arbitrarily low. But we can run what's called sub-threshold. What do I mean by sub-threshold? Let's consider our transistor. Okay, so if we consider this as our input, and so we say this is going to be, let's actually do it this way. Let's say this is X's voltage, the amount of voltage we put on X from 0 up to 1. Doesn't have to be 1. Let's go all the way up to 2 volts. Okay? And theoretically, we could even go negative if we had some way of drawing more power away from it, if we were actually attached to a battery instead of just ground. So there's no real boundaries necessarily on this. And on the vertical axis, we can have effectively the resistance. What we mean by saying a transistor is closed, we mean it has an extremely high resistance. And so what we want out of our transistors is we want this resistance to be way up off the charts, but we'll just put it at the top here, okay? It's acting like a resistor. It's not allowing any current. It's acting like an insulator even. Okay, so we have sort of insulator up here. We have something like a wire down here, sort of the range we have. And so at 0 volts, we want it to act like an insulator. And we want it to have some sort of situation where it comes down here, and down here, it acts like a wire, very little resistance. And so we want to have these differences between on and off, right? We have off here, we have on here. And that defines the threshold for our system. Sub-threshold systems won't go all the way. They won't run at a voltage that will ever turn our gates all the way on. They'll run at a voltage that doesn't quite turn our gates on. This can save a lot of power by reducing the voltages. And there have been various studies that have gotten these voltages dramatically lower than the full threshold of what we're doing. But the consequence is we are sometimes wrong. If we don't let the voltage go all the way to fully opening our gate, then there's a chance that the current didn't flow through and didn't trigger the next gate. And so we can end up having chips that have really low power, but occasionally give us the wrong answer. Occasionally they act like they were closed when we thought they were open, because we just didn't go far enough to have it 100% sure. And so we can start building these chips that aren't as reliable, that make mistakes, but they make mistakes at a very low voltage. And then if we can characterize those mistakes, we might be able to check for the mistakes, right? Maybe you have four different circuits that all are occasionally wrong, but the chance they're all wrong together is really low. Or some other kind of system that can help us get our chips to run more effectively, lower power. Okay, I have a question about overclocking. I will get to overclocking. We haven't got to what overclocking does yet. So I'll get to what overclocking does here in a moment. So, at a broad stroke, how can we reduce power? We can hope to find a more power efficient circuit. And so over time, as the electrical engineering community and a computer engineering community comes up with new technologies, we get lower and lower power chips. We can make simpler ISAs. We can design chips that do less work. We can wait a little longer and use a little less voltage. Or we can try to design systems that are occasionally wrong, but use a lot less voltage. And these are sort of all techniques that are being used. And combined, all over time, we just see lower and lower power chips is the end result we observe. But that may mean changing our ASA. It may mean even changing our assumption that things are correct. So all of this assumes we want low power. But what if power is no object? What if I have infinite free power? Can I use power to make things faster? Let's talk about overclocking. All right. Several things are going on in overclocking. What I mean by overclocking, let's come back to our sort of basic single cycle system. I have a register. The clock goes in here. What I'm overclocking is I'm literally just making the clock run faster. Making the clock run faster means that all of these gates in here have a chance of not converging before I latch on the next answer. A chance of. Why do I say a chance of? Surely this is deterministic. It's kind of deterministic, okay? What controls transistor speed? We have many characteristics of transistor speed. One is voltage. More voltage, things move a little faster. One is actually temperature. Most transistor technologies that we use today, most electrical systems are more conductive at colder temperatures. So if we drop the temperature on our chip, it will run faster. However, if we drop it too much, it will stop behaving like a transistor. The semiconductor will become a conductor or something will crack and so on. So if we can keep the temperature down, but not too far down, we can make things run faster. Also, as I think about, if we just imagine we have a very simple system, okay, if we think about this voltage over time, if my voltage was supposed to have gone to 1, but I stop my clock cycle here, where it's instead of getting all the way up to 1 volt, it's just at 0.7, whether that will latch into my register as being a 1 or not will depend on chance. So I have several things going on here. I might have had this heat up too much, slow down. Or I might have been running just at this edge where it's almost always going to work, but occasionally getting the wrong thing. It's not because of sub-threshold, but it's instead because I haven't waited long enough for it to stabilize. And so overclocking, just turn up my clock speed, things can run faster, I should be able to get things running more quickly, but it might crash. This temperature matters. Because if we come back to power equals current times voltage, overclocking has a linear impact on current. I'm just doing more things per second, okay? So I'm increasing the current, which means I'm increasing the power in a linear way. But what do I mean when I say a chip consumes power? Energy is conserved. It's a fundamental understanding of physics. Energy doesn't go away. Okay? So when I think about my chip, I am putting in electricity. That power can't vanish. And there's only so many things it could do. It could cause macro vibrations that we call sound. It could emit photons we call light. Most processor chips are designed to do very little, if any, of either of that. And the only other thing it could do is cause heat. Heat meaning individual molecules moving faster inside the lattice that holds them in place, increasing temperature. When I increase the power, I increase the heat. Now, heat is not temperature. Heat is the creation of temperature. And so when I need, if I'm thinking about my chip sitting here, running away, it's a little wafer of silicon sitting here with wires to connect it to the rest of my computer. And it is running like a little oven. I'm pumping power into that power. That power is being consumed. The consequence of consuming power is the generation of heat. It is heating up. And so I need to get that heat away from the chip so the chip doesn't overheat. And so what we actually do is we attach on the top of it something we call a heat sink. And a heat sink is basically just a bunch of metal fins. Metal because it conducts heat very well, as well as electricity. Fins so the air can get on it. And then I put a fan that blows on it to try to get air to flow over this warm metal. The large surface area means it can conduct that air away, and then hopefully it'll blow warm air out of my computer. We typically ship computers so that this will work just fine. We typically ship portable computers, phones and tablets and so on, so that I don't even need the fan. I make them run at so low power that the heat they generate can just sort of dissipate out into the environment around it in a safe way, without it overheating, without the temperature getting so high the circuit stops working. But if I'm willing to remove heat in a more efficient way, I might be able to increase this equation, generate more heat without overheating. And so really, if you really want to make a commodity computer faster, you're going to both overclock it and add a more efficient cooling system. Typically liquid cooled, because liquids tend to have a higher ability to remove heat than gases like air. Other kinds of systems you can do, getting that right so that it never gets it too cold so it breaks, but still keeps it from overheating is a little tricky. And even that has a limit to what it can really do. So it's largely a placebo. You might get 20-30% more performance if you do all of these things very well. All of them have a chance of either occasionally moving too quickly and crashing the system, occasionally overcooling it or failing to cool it enough and burning it out or cracking it as it freezes. Lots of ways this can destroy your computer. But there are people that care enough about those last few steps to spend the energy. Okay. Thoughts, comments, questions about any of these ideas? Anything else you'd like to know about how computers are actually running? I should comment, the next topic stops talking about processors and memory and how we build systems all together and starts talking about how we build security exploits based on all of the random things we've talked about this semester together. So anything about how computers are built you would like me to say that we have not yet said? All right. Let's just see what this means in practice. This is the processor on the computer I am running. Okay? Lots of information. We should be able to understand almost all of this at this point. Let's see if we can explore what it means. Quad core. I have inside my computer a single wafer that has four separate processors on it. Four processors. The particular model is listed here. Why do I care about the exact model? Well, the instruction set is based on the just sort of the Core i7 instruction set. So Intel Core i7 is the instruction set architecture. It's a version of the x86 that has a particular set of instructions. This then tells me the build. This is likely to have impact on things like the internal structure, how deep the pipeline is, what the microcodes are, my microinstructions, and so forth. I have 64 bits. Addresses take 64 bits, although in this particular case, only 48 of those bits have meaning, but those are the address bits I have. Okay, I have multi-threaded. Okay, so I have, although I have four cores, you'll see down here it lists 8 of them in practice, because each of them is designed to be able to run 2 simultaneous threads. My L2 cache is 8 gigabytes. So it doesn't tell me what my L1 cache is, but my L2 cache is 8 gigabytes. In general, not always, but in general, the L1 cache is per core. So each core will have its own L1 cache. The L2 cache is generally shared between the cores, meaning that things like any kind of atomic and memory instruction is going to have to go at least out to the L2 cache, because the L1 caches can't talk to each other. We have to go out to the L2 cache. I also see I'm running at this exact megahertz. My speed is 1513 megahertz. But the minimum and maximum clock speeds are between 800 and 4200 megahertz. Okay? Why would there be a range? Well, if I slow down my clock, I slow down my current. I slow down my current, I reduce my power. I am saving power by running at below the maximum. It can ramp itself up to 4.2 gigahertz and still have all instructions complete in time and have all heat safely dissipated. But it's currently running at a third that, because at a third that it's using a third as much power, and actually even less than a third as much power, because the lower power means lower heat. The lower heat means the transistors are running a little more efficiency, which also means I'm producing a little less heat. So I'm keeping the system cooler along the way. And then it shows me the megahertz of each of my 8 cores. How fast is each one of those running? Notice this doesn't quite match this speed, and partly that's because this tool has to measure them at different times. I could also look at my overall machine. I could see all kinds of serial numbers and so forth that were there. I can look at my memory system. And you can see, I have 15.59 gigabytes of RAM, 3.3.52 gigabytes are being used. Okay, and so I can see there's a lot of RAM that is not being used. What do we mean by not being used? We mean not in any processes physical linked by any processes page table. No process is using this memory. And so I could boot up another process that could use 12 gigabytes of RAM without needing to take RAM from anybody else on my system right now. Okay, now that may still have impact on other systems because I only have an 8 gigabyte L2 cache. Another thing you'll notice here though, or 8 megabyte L2 cache, right? So my L2 cache, dramatically smaller than the memory I'm using, which means a significant amount of that memory is not in the L2 cache, although it might be in a higher cache on all the way up. Okay, and if we really want to see everything about my computer, we can. So much information. I have, for example, seeing here that my CPU is sitting at 39.5 degrees centigrade. Okay, it knows how fast this is going. It needs to know how fast this is going because it needs to decide how fast to make this fan run. How fast should the fan go? If this gets too hot, it needs to make that fan go faster to dissipate heat, to keep it at a safe level. Also, I have a GPU and it has a different temperature. We're keeping track of all these separately. You can also see all of the different device drivers I have and what my disks are and how they're mounted and so forth. my network card, a lot of things we haven't talked about, okay? But we do have a lot of this kind of information about all of my different processes. You'll also notice as we come back to the CPU, I used to be running slower than this. It's bumped up in speed. The processor speed will tend to change very rapidly in modern computers. As soon as extra work appears, we'll bump up that clock speed. When extra work vanishes, we'll bump it down. We can do that in much less than a second. And so that will tend to vary quite quickly as our program runs. So just a little peek under the hood. All right. This concludes our survey of how computers are built. There's certainly a lot more to know about all of the different components. Why does the CPU have a minimum clock speed? That's a good question. Why would I ever have a minimum clock speed? What could be the downside to having it not to run too slow? Partly this has to do with the actual oscillator that generates the clock signal. Partly it's also an understanding that I want to be responsive. If I let my clock speed drop down to one cycle, that clock is needed to run the instructions to decide to change the clock speed. So that minimum clock speed partly is a technical thing, but partly will also make sure I remain sufficiently responsive. Why does the operating system control the sensors and speeds and such? So in general, it doesn't need to control them, although sometimes you want to be able to say what things to go faster. Some of them have hardware only. Some of them the operating system can only read, not write. Why would I allow it to read that? To perform entropy harvesting. Remember when we were talking about security, I want some piece of information that is unpredictable. The low order bits of those fan speeds and temperature sensors and so on, the high order bits are predictable based on workload, but the low order bits we consider to be relatively random. And so giving access to those various systems can help that work out. Also, my operating system might decide to defer some things that don't need to happen right away until a moment when I notice that the CPU is cool. Your CPU is getting hot. Maybe I won't run some of those daemon processes that I'll need to run on every few minutes. I'll just wait until your processor cools down. So providing that information can help it make more intelligent decisions. All right, that's the time we have. When we come back on Monday, we will dive into some modern security exploits based on some of these understandings of how processes work. I will just remind you that we do expect the servers to come up online on Saturday. Depending on when that happens, it may not be till Monday till I update the course information. The quiz won't open until Monday and close on Friday, and we will push back life an amount to be determined based on how long the servers were actually down. And with that, I will see you all on Monday.